Please turn to Genesis 37. Death is basically a fact of, it's a fact of life, you might say. Death is a fact of life in the Old Testament. All the way from Genesis, really 4, right? Where we have our first murder of Cain and Abel, okay? From chapter 3 of Genesis, of course, we have the declaration that we need to remove Adam and Eve from the garden so that they no longer have access to the tree of life. And so, because God did not want them any longer to live forever. But in chapter 4, with Cain and Abel, we actually get our first death, where Cain murders Abel, as you know that. The first time, though, that Sheol is mentioned is Genesis 37:35. And by the time that this happens, there have been thousands and thousands of deaths at this point. Death is just something that kind of happens. 37:35. Well, let's start in 34. Then Jacob tore his garments. All right. This is when Joseph is sold by his brothers. Then Jacob, 34. Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Let's turn to Genesis 42. We start in verse 35. This is, you remember the episode of the sons go to Egypt. Egypt, by this time, is essentially ruled by Joseph as Pharaoh's right-hand man. In verse 35, they emptied their sacks. You know, they brought back food from Joseph. Joseph had not revealed himself to them. I imagine you all remember the story. And they emptied their sacks. Behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Then Reuben said to his father, "Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you make, you should bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." All right? In this particular case, Jacob is not lamenting death, his own death. All right? He's going to die. I think something you see a lot in the Old Testament, all right? And this is very much in contrast with the New and generally how we conceive of things. The Old Testament is not afraid of death and punishment in that death. That's not really an Old Testament idea. That's something that really develops later. What they're afraid of is things like this. Jacob says, "I don't want to go down to Sheol after Benjamin and Joseph are dead. All right? I don't want them killed and therefore me go down to Sheol in sorrow. I want, all right, I want my sons to be alive. I've already lost two. I don't want to lose another." That's what they're trying to avoid. And we'll see this in various ways as we look at Psalms and Proverbs and prophets and whatnot as we go through. The idea, all right, really the idea of the Old Testament, or excuse me, of the Bible is this idea of punishment in the grave, punishment after death, is progressively revealed. This is something that we will see very clearly in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, maybe it's hinted out a few times, maybe it could be implied, but it is not really something that they sit down and they discuss, right? Where when you have the parable of Lazarus and the rich man in the New Testament, it's really clear. This guy is burning and is in pain. This guy is actually quite happy in a pleasant place. Very clear. So we're going to go through some things, various things about Sheol today. We're also going to cover a few passages that some might take as about an idea of punishment in Sheol, and we'll look at them contextually, and we'll talk about how I don't think that actually makes sense here. So we're going to general talk about various things, and there are some sections where we're going to dig in and see how the ideas about death develop. So Genesis 37, 35, and Genesis 42, all right? Jacob is worried about going to death, essentially, in sorrow, all right? Not for punishment or anything like that, just wanting, well, he wants his legacy, right, to live on. This is part of the promise that goes through Abraham, and he specifically is thinking of his two children, Benjamin and Joseph, and definitely does not want them to die. Let's go to Isaiah 38. This is jumping ahead a good bit. Isaiah chapter 38. Hezekiah, king of Judah. Hezekiah, good king or bad king? Good, mostly good. Yeah, he has some issues, but generally speaking, he's way better than a great deal of the kings of Judah. Chapter 38, in those days Hezekiah became sick and was at the point of death, and Isaiah the prophet, son of Amoz, came to him and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die. You shall not recover." Then Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord and said, "Please, O Lord, remember how I have walked before you in faithfulness and with a whole heart, and have done what is good in your sight." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, "Go and say to Hezekiah, thus says the Lord, the God of David your father, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears. Behold, I will add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and will defend this city. This shall be the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he has promised. Behold, I will make the shadow cast by the declining sun on the dial of Ahaz turn back 10 steps. So the sun turned back on the dial, the 10 steps by which it had declined. And so Hezekiah is given a new lease on life. What's really interesting is this little poem or song he writes. Verse 9, a writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, after he had been sick and had recovered from his sickness. I said, in the middle of my days I must depart. I am consigned to the gates of Sheol for the rest of my years. I said, I shall not see the Lord in the land of the living. I shall look on man no more among the inhabitants of the world. My dwelling is plucked up and removed from me like a shepherd's tent. Like a weaver, I have rolled up my life. He cuts me off from the loom, and from day to night you bring me to an end. I calmed myself until the morning. Like a lion, he breaks all my bones. From day to night you bring me to an end. And so on. I want to stop at that point. Let's just reflect on what we've seen so far. The problem here is not that Hezekiah is dying. I don't think that's... I mean, he's obviously lamenting. This is about... Right, when he thought he was dying, right? He is, of course, lamenting that. But notice the wording. In the middle of my days, I must depart. Right? Everybody expected death. All right? Everybody expected death, unless you're like Enoch or Elijah. Everyone expected death. What's the problem? The problem is in the middle of my days. All right? That's the problem. An early death. Or a shameful death, as we'll see in other places. Or the idea of dying shamefully, all right? That's really the problem. I mean, death is a problem, obviously. But he's mourning in the middle of my days. And you know what? I'm going to spend the rest of my days in this sick bed. You're not going to see me in the land of the living. I'm just stuck here. And where's he stuck at? Stuck at the gates of Sheol. All right, so we see where this imagery is. What does it mean to stuck at the gates of Sheol? It's a really simple idea. All right, he's almost dead. He's just hanging on to dear life. What are the gates of Sheol? It's just the entrance. It's nothing special. It's just the entrance of Sheol. And he views himself as just, he's almost there. Is he in Sheol? No. But he's at the gates, and he's about to go in there. And so this is the problem for Hezekiah. It's, God, you're cutting me off middle of my life. Or at least that was the idea until God extended his life. We can see this in other ways. Turn to the book of Numbers. There is a particular phrase. It shows up twice in Numbers and once in Proverbs. Numbers 16 is where we're going. This is Korah's rebellion. Right? You might recall this story. Korah's rebellion. Here in Numbers 16, we'll start in verse 31. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up. And the fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. Sent into Sheol alive. Same thing that you'll see in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 12. What's the idea? That Korah and his family were put in Sheol and stayed alive there? No, that's not the idea. The idea is it's a way of saying premature death, right? When do you expect to go to Sheol? Well, when you're old. And then you get feeble, more feeble. It's just the way God has assigned us so many years. That's when we expect to go to Sheol. When's Korah going to go to Sheol? Not like that, right? In the midst of his life, all right, alive, opened up, swallowed. Not to live in Sheol alive, but it's really just a way of saying death, swallowed up in the middle of your life, coming to an end. All right, this is an ignominious death. This is not the kind of death that you want. Now turn to Job. Let's talk a little bit about what the Old Testament says Sheol is like. I haven't found anything yet, and if you find one, please do tell me. I've not found anything yet that associates Sheol with fire in the Old Testament. If you find it, please let me know. Job 17. What's Sheol like? Verse 13. If I hope for Sheol as my house, if I make my bed in darkness. So what's Sheol like? It's darkness. If I say to the pit, it's like a pit, you're my father. And to the worm, worm? Maybe earthworms, maybe maggots. Right? Decomposing body, being eaten by worms in the dead. Anyway, if I say to the pit, you're my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars or gates of Sheol? Shall we descend together into the dust? So Sheol, it's a place of darkness. It's a place of worms or maggots. It's a place of dust. Turn to chapter 26. Job 26:4. With whose help have you uttered words, and whose breath has come out from you? The dead tremble under the waters in their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has, or Abaddon has, no covering. So it's also wet. Okay. Why would you characterize Sheol as wet? All right. Think about it for a second. Where is Sheol in terms of? Here's a good word for you to know, because this is the word they use in the literature. All right. In terms of the cosmology, okay, the study of how things are arranged. Cosmos, right? Cosmos. We think of cosmos as the stars. In general, it just means arrangement, design. So if we think about how things are arranged, where is Sheol? Sheol is down, right? You bury people down there. If, forbid it, you die on the sea, where do you go? Well, you sink to the bottom, right? Nobody goes up. That's not the idea. It's really rare for somebody to actually go up. So Sheol is down, all right? You live in the middle of the desert. Where's the water? Down, right? Sheol's wet. Why would you think that? Because when you dig deep down far enough, that's where you find the water, right? As an image, well, it works. But what about dust? Same thing. You bury somebody in the ground, and they will ultimately turn to dust. All these things make sense, all right? Like I said, I haven't seen yet, and it may exist, I have not seen yet a place where Sheol is compared with fire, all right? Why? Well, sure, we know, right, there's lots of lava down there, right? That was not normal for them, right? You don't go digging a well in Israel and go, oops, I hit lava, right? That's not what happens, and so therefore that's not really a part of their description in the Old Testament. You don't get that ultimately until you get later. So let's go ahead and turn to Proverbs chapter 1, because I want to spend some time just reading through all of Proverbs chapter 5, but first we'll stop at Proverbs chapter 1 on the way. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching, for they are a graceful garland for your head, and pendants for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive. Right? There's our Sheol. And whole, like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our house with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths. There's Sheol, and there's that once again, you know, bringing down to Sheol live. All right? Contextually, what's going on? That's talking about ambushing people, right? It's talking about robbing them and maybe killing them before their prime of life. Once again, taking people down into Sheol alive. Now, generally speaking, when you read the Proverbs, right? So we're going to read all of Proverbs chapter 5 because there is an instance of Sheol there. When you read the Proverbs, what, all right, when you think about the negative consequences of sin, what is... what's the location? What's the location where you receive those negative results of sin in Proverbs? Generally speaking, is it afterlife or is it life? Generally, it's in this life. If you read Proverbs, let's read all of chapter 5, and we'll see it. Proverbs chapter 5. A warning against adultery. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. For the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways wander, and she does not know it. Now, you could read this and think, and here's the logical argument here. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. everyone's going to die. All right? Everyone's going to die. So therefore, if her path leads to Sheol, maybe this is talking about something more than just the place of the dead. That's the argument. I'm going to argue for no, that's not the case. Let's keep reading. "And now, O sons, listen to me, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others, and your years to the merciless, lest strangers take their fill of your strength, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner, and at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and body are consumed, and you say, 'How I hated discipline, and my heart despised reproof. I did not listen to the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to my instructors. I am at the brink of utter ruin and the assembled congregation.'" And then he goes on with the contrast. "Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well." Of course, talking about keeping the marriage bed undefiled, all right? Not going to see prostitutes or adulterers. So think about that sequence when it's talking about the negative, about talking about going and seeing the adulteress. What's the negative consequences of this? Throughout all of this, except for maybe that one verse, we'll come back to it. Throughout all of this, notice, where's the problem, all right? Where are you going to get the negative consequences of dealing with the adulteress, of being with the adulteress? If you look at it, it is all very much this worldly. All right, let's read it again. Verse 8, "Keep your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the merciless." I think he's speaking about, well, first of all, you're giving away your honor, but also you are basically setting yourself up for some retribution, right? If this is, you know, adultery, for example, with someone else's wife. "Lest strangers take their fill of your strength, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner, and at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and body are consumed." This is all about end of your life, as in you look back on your life and you basically realize, my resources and my body and my life has been destroyed by this relationship with the adulterous woman. And you say, "How I hated discipline in my life, and my heart despised reproof. I do not listen to the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to my instructors. I am at the brink of utter ruin in the assembled congregation." You know, in the Israelite assembly, when they weren't in total apostasy, all right, so, and they often were, but in general, in the congregation of the Israelites, all right, this kind of activity, when the Israelites are godly, is going to bring you shame in the congregation in life. That's what all of this is about. That's the focus here. So now let's go back and look at verse 5. Verse 4, "But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to Sheol. Her steps follow the path." Excuse me. "Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways wander, and she does not know it." What's the punishment for adultery in the law? Stoning, right? So in a very real sense, being with the adulteress can lead to, well, Sheol, quite literally, you getting killed. It could be just retribution from a jealous husband. It could be judicial stoning. That's really what this is about. And another thing that really clinches this for me, all right? Remember back when we were talking about Hebrew poetry? And how Hebrew poetry, they like to put things in parallel, and then you can often use those parallels to help you interpret things. That goes on all the time in Proverbs, and it helps us here in this verse. "Her feet go down to death, her steps follow the path to Sheol." So therefore, what's parallel to feet? Path. What is Sheol? It is death, based on the parallel. And so if you want to take something like this, and there's various verses like this, where you do some sin and it says it's going to lead you to Sheol. All right? It might be tempting sometime to go, okay, well, maybe this is talking about not just death because everyone dies. Maybe this is a punishment within Sheol. I don't think so. And in this particular case, all of the negative consequences of dealing with the adulterous woman here in Proverbs chapter 5, they're all this worldly. All right? They are all this worldly. Possible death, issues with money, issues with your relationships with other Israelites. All right? And so read contextually, this kind of thing, I think, really leads us to the same conclusion. This is very much in contrast. Think about the language here. This is very much in contrast to the way that we really look at things, right? Why? We're later. We come from a time of progressive revelation where more is revealed, all right? Yes, there are negative consequences to adultery in this life even now, all right? We all know this. But we also have a whole lot more revelation, and we'll often go somewhere else, which is to say, God says no, all right? Or as Paul multiple times says, there are certain types of people that don't make it into the kingdom of God. Here's one of them right here, all right? We've got a lot more information, and so we go there. I don't think the Old Testament really goes there. I really think this is a later development. Let's look at another one. Let's go to Psalms.
Hey,
yes, sir.
Why do you think the Old Testament wouldn't have gone there? Because it's clearly one of the worst things that God's picked, because you're punished by death and the old law.
Yeah. Well, I think... And here's, let me be clear about where it doesn't go, all right? The Old Testament is very clear that there are negative punishments to sin, all right? And then God put them in the law, all right? There are negative consequences to sin. Sometimes they're judicial, sometimes they will be just some bad things happening in your life. To be precise, where the Old Testament I don't think really goes is describing after you're dead what that experience is like. Specifically, a bifurcation in terms of a cosmology of what happens. Any sort of split in Sheol that says the bad people go to a bad place in Sheol. The good people go to a good or okay place in Sheol. Why doesn't... I just think God chose not to reveal it. When you get to the New Testament, it's pretty clear. Split in two. Yeah. Sheol seems to be, generally speaking from the Old Testament, a place where everyone goes. Without a whole lot of or any speculation to what's it like other than it's dark, it's dusty, it's wet, there's worms there. Why? Well, all of these things are characteristic of things under the ground, right? I cannot. Yeah, it's just, from my reading, it's just not revealed. Yeah. Which is the case for a lot of things. Right? Now, there are a few, and whenever you get the next versions of your notes, you'll see this. There are a few things in the Old Testament that look forward or might imply, for example, some sort of removal from Sheol. For example, and you'll get the scripture list and you can think through it. You've got David saying at one point, I really hope when I awake that I will see, be with you in righteousness and behold your face, talking to God. Okay? Well, that doesn't sound like Sheol. Isaiah 25 has some very positive things about God destroying death in it. Daniel 12, I think, is the only very clear, explicit reference to resurrection, any sort of general resurrection in the Old Testament, all right? Not that no one was resurrected, but any sort of general resurrection, which is really late in the Old Testament. So this is all progressive revelation. God does not reveal everything at the beginning of Genesis. And I think our idea of punishment in the afterlife is very much a later development. which we'll see very clearly in the New Testament, we'll also see did show up very clearly in the intertestamental period. Yeah. All I think it means he didn't tell us. There's lots of things God does not tell us. That's all. That's really all. That's all I'm willing to speculate about it, is that it's just not there. Psalm chapter 9, please. This is an interesting one. This is not on an individual level. All right? We're going to read the whole psalm. It's not that long. So we can get the context. All right? So this is to the choir master, according to Muthlabin, a psalm of David. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will recount all of your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, stop. When we're talking about David and his enemies, what kind of enemies are we talking about usually? We're talking about people want to kill him, right? Philistines in some cases, Saul in some cases, other nations in some cases. We can see at this point, here's our context. This is general national warfare. Somebody wants to kill David. When my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before your presence. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. And so David is actually talking about winning in this particular case. All right. What does it mean for God to give righteous judgment with David against his enemies? It means for David to win in war. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy come to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. But the Lord sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for justice, and he judges the world with righteousness. He judges the people with uprightness. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know your name put their trust in you. For you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who sits enthroned in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds. For he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Be gracious to me, O Lord. See my affliction from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death. Once again, here's our gates of Sheol. Who lift me up from the gates of death that I may recount all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion I may rejoice in your salvation. The nations have sunk in the pit that they made, in the net they hid. Their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. The wicked are snared in the works of their own hands. The wicked shall return to Sheol, all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know they are but men. What does it mean for God to judge the nations? This is not talking about post-death judgment. This is talking about David fighting a war. God judged the nations. All right. What does that mean? Let them return to Sheol. What does that mean? Let my armies win. That's the whole context of this. None of this is about punishment after death. Even though it talks about nations going down to Sheol, it's nothing like that at all. It's really just about God, you've said you're on my side, and you know, except with a few mess-ups, David was, in fact, a righteous king. And so he's asking for, be at my side, execute righteous judgment. They're wicked, I'm righteous, let's do this. And generally speaking, that was the case. All right? David won. Why? Because God exercised righteous judgment. And so you might, especially like read that last bit, you know, let the nations be judged before you, and be thinking, well, this is talking about some sort of eschatological judgment. And that's really, contextually, There's no idea of anything like that here in the Psalms. And generally speaking, that's what's going on in your Old Testament. All right? The focus is on Sheol being the place of the dead. There's some other things that I think are really interesting. There's a number of places, all right, where, and we've already said this, you'll have the verses whenever I send you out a new version. Job 11:8, Amos 9:2, Psalm 139:8, where the focus isn't so much of what Sheol is, you can assume that from everywhere else, but that Sheol is the opposite of heaven, all right? Like when David says, you know, God can find me wherever I'm at. What are those possible places? As high as heaven, he's there. As low as Sheol, well, he's there too, right? And so God can go everywhere. How do you say the what two things are most far apart to show how omnipresent God is? Up there and down there, right? Which will be really interesting when we try to apply that to the idea of Sheol and paradise when we get to the New Testament. But that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Here.
Yes, sir.
Verse 5 of Psalm 9.
Yeah.
What does it mean to have your name blotted out forever and ever?
Mm-hmm.
And often the righteous are talked about that their names will be remembered.
Mm-hmm. So, generally speaking, and then we'll look here in context. Generally speaking, you think like Abraham, all right? How will Abraham's name be remembered forever and ever? Well, he will have children, and they will have children, and they will have children, and so forth, all right? And God will essentially establish his name, and we do still talk about Father Abraham. So that's the general idea. How many nations have existed that we do not know the name of? How many people have existed that we do not know the name of? Most of them, right? Now, that's the general idea. Contextually here, take a look. So in verse 5, you have rebuked the nations, you have made the wicked perish, you have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy came to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. It's a military idea, all right? You don't just go and capture that city and subjugate it. You go and you destroy it, all right? You tear its walls down, you kill everybody there or take them into slavery, and you wipe the city out so that the city itself is gone from memory. That's the idea here. It's just, this. What's going to happen to this nation? You think you're all powerful, who's going to remember you? No one. Because you will ultimately be defeated in battle and wiped out, which is the case for, you know, most cities and settlements throughout human history. We don't know who they are, or even that there are ruins a few feet under the ground from where we might be walking. So I think that's the idea there.
Would be the same, though, like the vast majority of the righteous we don't remember.
True. It's true. But what's the focus here? David's saying, what's the promise to David? All right, the promise to David is, I'm going to make you king. And not just make you king, but your sons will be kings forever. In other words, your name won't be blotted out. Whose will be? Well, we actually still remember Babylon, but only because, well, we keep recalling the scriptures that talk about Babylon being destroyed as a judgment against, as a judgment from God. And so the idea here is really, it's just that, I think. It's dynastic. It's David, depending on the promise of God, is I will forever have a throne because I will forever have a descendant in that throne. Unlike that nation, we're going to wipe out their descendants because they have attacked David. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I think that's the idea there. Here's an interesting one, and then this will be something for you to think about. Turn to a book of Jonah. There's 65 instances of Sheol in the Old Testament, and they all generally fit into the, it's where you go when you die, right? They all generally fit into that. So we're not going to go through them all. But this one is particularly interesting because this is one of our favorite Bible stories. All right? Let's read Jonah chapter 2. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am driven away from your sight, yet I shall look again. I shall again look upon your holy temple. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head at the roots of the mountains. I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah out upon the dry land. Okay? Just think about this, all right? Just think about this idea. What's the miracle of Jonah? That he was kept alive in the fish for 3 days, or that he died and God raised him from the dead? Where does he, how, think about how he describes himself here and his experiences. It's a mixture. It's not altogether clear here from what I can see. But think about the descriptions. Where was he? He was in Sheol. Maybe, well, this is poetry. This is a song. Maybe he's being poetic. But, verse 6, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. What's that? Well, that's Sheol, right? Yet you brought my life from the pit. What's the pit? Sheol. Okay. What's the miracle of Jonah? Which one is it? Here's one thing to think about. Turn to Matthew chapter 12, related to that. Is the miracle of Jonah being kept alive, or is the miracle of Jonah actually an Old Testament resurrection? Matthew chapter 25. No, excuse me. Matthew chapter 12. Here we get Jesus talking about Jonah, all right? The point of Jesus is here not to expound upon Jonah, all right? But I think the way he talks about Jonah, I think, and I'm open to your thoughts on this, I think what Jesus is, the way he interprets it, I think he interprets it as Jonah died in the whale. Matthew chapter 12, verse 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you. But he answered them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Okay. This is what makes me think about really interpreting this as Jonah being dead. All right, what's the sign of Jonah to Jesus? All right, well, we know what Jesus' sign is that he's saying here. Here's the only sign I'm going to give you. I'm going to die. And in 3 days, I'm going to be raised from the dead. That's the sign he's talking about. If Jesus understood the sign of Jonah to be Jonah alive, then that really would be a miracle, right? Somebody swallowed by a very large fish for 3 days. That's a pretty amazing miracle to be kept alive during that. That would be a truly amazing miracle. But by analogy, it doesn't fit nearly as well. Because Jesus isn't saying, all right, I am going to be buried, but I will still be alive that whole time. And then 3 days I will come out of the grave. That's not what Jesus is saying at all. Jesus is saying, when he says, I'm going to go into the belly of the earth, what's that mean? Buried. Dead. Sheol. All right. So I think, based on Jesus' interpretation, that's what he's saying. He's saying, what's the sign of Jonah? Jonah died, and then he was raised after 3 days. Here's the sign you're going to see from me. You're going to kill me, but 3 days later I'm coming back. All right? So think about Jonah. Go read Jonah chapter 2. It doesn't explicitly say, but a lot of the imagery there is and wording, is Sheol imagery and Sheol wording. Of course, he's also very much thinking, right, during this happens. He's praying to God while he is in Sheol. And then, of course, this is a piece of poetry about this experience. And so how much of it is just a poetic description versus how much is he really trying to define what's it like to be in Sheol? You can only take this so far. But anyway, please think about that and give me your thoughts either now or later about Jonah. What do you think about that idea? Because I always grew up thinking that the miracle of Jonah was being kept alive in the fish for 3 days and then being vomited out to then go preach in Nineveh. Maybe that's actually not the idea. Some things to look forward to whenever you get the notes. I really would recommend you go back and read Psalm 17, which is where David expected to see God face to face. There's some stuff in Psalm 49 that I wanted to actually read through together as a group, but we won't have time today. Isaiah 25, as I mentioned, where God said he will destroy death. And of course, Daniel 12. There's perhaps hints and ideas of resurrection and escape from Sheol. There's one from Job, which frankly, I don't understand. I also have that listed in there, and it'd be great for you to think about it, see if you have any thoughts. So there's an idea, maybe, of an escape from Sheol. All right, of maybe it's not going to be that bad. But I just don't see the idea of punishment after death for the wicked and blessings for the righteous after death as an Old Testament idea. But we'll see it whenever we get to the New Testament. Yeah, do you have your hand up?
Yeah. The Bible uses swallow for Job. Mm-hmm. It doesn't use sits in the mouth of the whale.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So he would be dead. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would agree, unless God performs a miracle and keeps him alive.
Good point.
Yeah. The question is, the language in there, all right, there's a lot of Sheol-type language, all right? Is it picturing him as almost going to Sheol, or is it picturing him in Sheol? And if he's in Sheol, I think that implies that he actually died. Like I said, think about it. Any other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
I've never really thought about it that way before, but just thinking about it now, I always considered the whale or the fish as sent to save Jonah, not necessarily to kill him, because it seems like the whole point of him being thrown out of the boat was to kill him, right? So mm-hmm. It seems like the fish was there to save him. But it also makes sense what you're saying. So maybe just the fish was sort of symbolically viewed as Sheol for him because it was dark.
Could be.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's poetry, and people do very do things with very strong imagery in poetry. Yeah. And if that's the case, it's the whale isn't there. I mean, either way, the whale is not there just to save Jonah. The whale is there to put Jonah back on mission, right? He needs to get vomited out so he can then go preach to Nineveh. And so whether that's saving, not even punishment, it's the vehicle that God chose to get him from middle of the sea back to land. He chose a fish, and he either miraculously kept him alive in the fish, or he killed him, but then brought him back alive whenever they got to dry land. Yes, Chip.
I think I'm not sure if it was a whale.
Those fish are really small. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really say. It doesn't really say exactly what kind of fish it is.
Back then, they probably couldn't differentiate a whale, a mammal, and a fish.
Yeah, they did know that they were very large fish. They didn't. There were whales in the Mediterranean, so they would have seen them. Not that the Israelites were particularly seafaring people, but they had lots of contact with people that were, and so whales were a known quantity at the time. Same with the other two options. It's not possible for somebody to live alive in the belly of a fish unless God makes it so. And it's not possible for somebody to be dead in the belly of a fish, being partially digested. We know how this would work. But then brought back to life. Also not possible. Well, all things are possible with God. So it's a miracle either way. It's just a question. What's Jesus going for, and what's the Old Testament trying to say there? We are out of time, so if you want to discuss any of this more, let me know. If you have any particular verses you want to discuss next time, I'm going to plan on talking about starting into the New Testament and also talking about some of the ideas in the intertestamental period that will help us understand, I think, some of what we see in the New Testament. So let me know if you have anything in particular you want to talk about, any disagreements, anything like that. Just let me know, and we will certainly discuss it, okay? Jonathan, will you pray for us, please?